When Cassandra Clare's City of Fallen Angels hit shelves in 2011, it shattered records as the #1 New York Times bestseller for 6 consecutive weeks. As the 4th installment in the Mortal Instruments series, it marked a pivotal expansion of what was originally planned as a trilogy. The book resonated deeply with young adult readers navigating their own identity struggles, while Hollywood producers scrambled to secure rights for what would become both a film franchise and the popular Shadowhunters television series. What makes this urban fantasy so compelling isn't just its supernatural elements, but how it uses the paranormal as a lens to explore very human questions. How well do we truly know ourselves? Can we escape our family's legacy? And perhaps most hauntingly, can love survive our darkest impulses? Simon Lewis finds himself in an impossible situation. As a newly turned vampire with the rare ability to walk in daylight, he straddles two worlds, a mundane human existence he once knew, and the supernatural realm he now belongs to. His predicament intensifies when Camille, the former head of the Manhattan Vampire Clan, approaches him with an enticing offer. Join forces with her against Raphael, who betrayed her by framing her for murder. She dangles the promise of knowledge Raphael has withheld, including how to speak God's name despite being a vampire. Simon's struggle extends beyond vampire politics to his personal life. Living with his increasingly suspicious mother creates a painful charade as he tries to maintain the illusion of normalcy. The memory spell Magnus cast on her prevents her from remembering his unexplained absences, but it can't erase her maternal intuition that something is deeply wrong with her son. This creates heartbreaking moments where Simon watches his mother asleep on the couch, whispering his name, unable to wake her without facing questions he can't answer. His romantic entanglements further complicate matters as well, as he finds himself dating both Isabel and Maya simultaneously, neither aware of the other. When Clary warns him about this dangerous game, Simon defends himself with the technicality that he never had an exclusivity conversation with either woman. His justification reveals his deeper struggle, clinging to mundane social norms while supernatural forces reshape his existence. The most poignant moment comes when Simon's mother discovers bottles of blood in his room. After his confession that he's a vampire, her horror and religious terror, praying in a way that causes him physical pain through God's name, forces Simon to use his vampire powers to make her believe it was all a dream. As he packs and leaves home, using his abilities to implant the false memory of a school trip, Simon embodies the ultimate outsider, rejected by his own mother and forced to become a fugitive and wanderer on Earth, just like the biblical Cain whose mark he bears. While Simon grapples with his supernatural identity, Jace Lightwood faces a more insidious battle within himself. Despite his passionate relationship with Clary, recurring nightmares plague him, violent visions where he attacks the very person he loves most. These dreams grow increasingly vivid and disturbing, featuring scenes where he watches helplessly as his hands wrap around Clary's throat or his blade pierces her heart. These dreams leave him physically ill and emotionally withdrawn, often waking in cold sweats with his sheets tangled around him, reflecting his deepest fear that he might have inherited Valentine's darkness. During training sessions with Clary in the Institute's attic, we glimpse moments of the old Jace, teasing, confident, and protective as he catches her mid-fall from a training beam. His reflexes remain lightning quick, his combat instincts sharp as ever, demonstrating the physical prowess that made him legendary among young Shadowhunters. Their physical attraction remains undimmed by familiarity, evident in the lingering touches and heated glances they exchange between practice bouts. But something has changed. When Jace accidentally refers to Valentine as my father, his slip reveals the anxiety that Jocelyn views him as Valentine's second coming, a concern Clary has carefully kept from him while trying to maintain peace between them. This verbal stumble haunts him for days, each word feeling like a betrayal of his true family, the Lightwoods. Jace's internal mantra, "I'm not like Valentine," becomes increasingly desperate as he questions whether his lack of remorse for killing Jonathan reveals an inherited darkness. He obsessively analyzes his past actions, searching for signs of Valentine's influence in every decision he's ever made. His struggle manifests physically when he pulls away from intimate moments with Clary, telling her he loves her more than I probably should. His hands shake when they're alone together, and he finds himself counting the steps between them, maintaining a careful distance. This self-imposed separation stems from his fear of becoming the monster in his dreams, creating a painful paradox. His attempt to protect Clary by withdrawing only deepens her concern and confusion. The Steely Queen exploits this vulnerability during her unexpected appearance in Central Park, taunting Clary by questioning whether Jace truly loves and desires her. She weaves subtle poison into her words, suggesting that perhaps Jace's distance stems not from protection, but from a growing darkness that finds Clary's pure heart repulsive. This psychological warfare targets the couple's greatest insecurity, that their love might be tainted by Jace's connection to Valentine. The Queen's words echo in Jace's mind, amplifying his self-doubt and feeding his fears. When Jace later admits to Simon that he's deliberately staying away from Clary but won't explain why, he cryptically states, "There are more important things than honesty," revealing how far he'll go to shield her from what he believes is growing inside him. This confession to Simon, of all people, shows the depth of his desperation, turning to a former rival for understanding when he can't burden Clary with his darkness. The Steely Queen exploits this vulnerability during her unexpected appearance in Central Park, taunting Clary by questioning whether Jace truly loves and desires her. She weaves subtle poison into her words, suggesting that perhaps Jace's distance stems not from protection, but from a growing darkness that finds Clary's pure heart repulsive. This psychological warfare targets the couple's greatest insecurity, that their love might be tainted by Jace's connection to Valentine. The Queen's words echo in Jace's mind, amplifying his self-doubt and feeding his fears. When Jace later admits to Simon that he's deliberately staying away from Clary but won't explain why, he cryptically states, "There are more important things than honesty," revealing how far he'll go to shield her from what he believes is growing inside him. This confession to Simon, of all people, shows the depth of his desperation, turning to a former rival for understanding when he can't burden Clary with his darkness. Relationships in City of Fallen Angels exist in a precarious balance, where supernatural forces amplify ordinary human complications. Clary and Deuce's romance, once seemingly unbreakable after surviving the revelation they weren't siblings, now faces a new threat from within. Their training sessions provide fleeting moments of normalcy, Jace teaching Clary Muay Thai combat techniques or showing her amusing vacation photos of Alec and Magnus in Europe. Yet these glimpses of happiness are overshadowed by Jace's increasing withdrawal, manifesting in missed training sessions and cryptic text messages that leave Clary questioning everything they've built together. The novel explores how supernatural elements complicate relationships across multiple couples, each facing unique challenges that test their bonds. Magnus and Alec's romance confronts the ultimate relationship obstacle, immortality versus mortality. Their conversations about the future become increasingly fraught, particularly during a quiet evening in Magnus's apartment when Alec discovers a box of mementos from Magnus's past lovers. When Alec confronts Magnus about seeming too accepting of his eventual death, Magnus makes a heart-wrenching confession. "I realize now that I won't be any more ready to lose you then than I am right now." Their solution, simply to hope, captures the novel's bittersweet approach to love against impossible odds, though the weight of time's inevitable march haunts their every intimate moment. Simon's romantic entanglements with both Isabel and Maya create a more conventional love triangle, yet one complicated by vampire politics and werewolf pact dynamics. His inability to choose between them stems partly from disbelief that either would truly want him, revealing his lingering insecurity about his vampire nature. These insecurities manifest in small ways: his hesitation to drink blood in front of either woman, his careful positioning away from sunlight during dates, his constant awareness of his own heartlessness.
When both women discover his two-timing at the Alto Bar, their fury transcends supernatural divisions, demonstrating that some betrayals remain universally unforgivable regardless of species. Luke and Jocelyn represent a more mature love, weathering supernatural complications, their relationship serving as a beacon of hope for the younger couples. Their upcoming wedding requires modifications, since Luke, as a werewolf, cannot bear the angel's runes in a traditional Shadowhunter ceremony. This accommodation symbolizes their relationship's foundation, mutual respect for their different natures while finding common ground. Their wedding planning sessions become moments of reflection on how love can bridge seemingly insurmountable differences, with even the most traditional Shadowhunters accepting their union. Perhaps most poignantly, Isabel's guarded heart gradually opens to Simon despite her determination to avoid serious relationships. Her transformation is revealed through small moments, her unexpected visits to his band practices, leaving her perfume-scented scarf in his room, defending him to her skeptical family. Standing in Simon's sparse bedroom at Jordan's apartment, she's struck by how empty and impersonal it is, just bare walls, a futon mattress, and a single window. Listening to city sounds, she reflects on his loneliness and regrets keeping him at a distance, revealing how love can flourish even amid supernatural chaos. Their developing relationship demonstrates how vulnerability, once embraced, can transform even the most carefully constructed emotional barriers. Simon's Mark of Cain represents one of the novel's most fascinating paradoxes: absolute protection that creates absolute isolation. When attacked by hooded figures speaking an unknown language, Simon warns them to leave him alone. As one pulls a gun, the mark activates. The weapon explodes, killing the attacker, who dissolves into salt. Jace later quotes scripture about vengeance belonging to the Lord, underscoring the biblical weight of Simon's protection. This divine safeguard comes with a terrible price. Raphael refuses Simon's sanctuary at the Dumont Hotel, saying Simon doesn't accept what he truly is, living among humans and playing in his band rather than embracing vampire existence. The mark further separates Simon from vampire society, making him both coveted and feared. As Luke explains, Simon's daylighter power acts as a magnet for those who desire power, attracting dangerous attention. The mark's most devastating consequence comes when Simon, overcome by bloodlust, attacks young fan Maureen backstage at his band's performance. Though she survives this encounter, she's later kidnapped by Lilith's cult, who believes she's Simon's girlfriend. Given the choice between death and vampirism, she chooses the latter, returning as a vampire messenger to warn Simon that everyone he loves will be targeted unless he cooperates. When Simon finally confronts Lilith on the rooftop, the mark reveals its true power. As Lilith's silver wire strikes him across the face and chest, a blinding ray of fire plunges from the sky, spearing through Lilith. She burns white against the darkness before transforming into thousands of salt crystals that rain down at Simon's feet. This biblical vengeance, sevenfold punishment for harming the Marked One, demonstrates why Lilith had been forced to manipulate others to attack Simon rather than harming him directly. Simon's conversation with Luke captures his existential crisis. Do you think it's possible to do something so bad, even if you didn't mean to do it, that you can never come back from it? Luke's wisdom, that suppressing one's true nature only gives it more control, offers Simon a path forward. Be what you are, Luke advises. No one who really loves you will stop. This counsel suggests that acceptance, not denial, might help Simon integrate his vampire nature with his humanity. A disturbing subplot emerges through Clary's investigation of the Church of Talto, a windowless building that subverts traditional sacred architecture. Instead of stained glass and holy symbols, the space is illuminated by black candles that cast writhing shadows across bare stone walls. At its center stands an imposing owl statue, its metallic eyes seeming to follow visitors, bearing an inscription in ancient demonic script warning of blood sacrifice and unholy transformation. The pews, rather than facing a cross, all point toward this ominous figure. At the altar, Clary discovers a black-handled athame, its blade marked with symbols that seem to move in the candlelight, marking a leather-bound tome written in a pre-demonic language. The book's yellowed pages contain elaborate summoning circles drawn in what appears to be dried blood, alongside a series of disturbing illustrations. These images tell a progressive story, first showing a woman with an owl perched on her shoulder, then the same woman heavily pregnant, followed by a scene of her being injected with a viscous red liquid that seems to glow on the page, and finally, the woman cradling a black-eyed infant with taloned hands. This discovery validates Jocelyn's worst fears about Valentine's legacy continuing through others attempting to recreate his experiments. During an intense conversation between Clary and Isabel, the latter's voice trembles with barely contained fury when discussing Jonathan/Sebastian. Isabel's insistence on using Sebastian rather than Jonathan, that's Jace's name and I won't let that monster taint it, reveals the deep psychological wounds Valentine's actions left on the younger generation of Shadowhunters. The horror escalates when Isabel, Alec, Jordan, and Maya investigate Lilith's building. In a room bathed in sickly green light, they find 47 stone pedestals arranged in concentric circles. Each holds a silver basket resembling an ancient Roman cradle, containing the preserved remains of infants with grotesque mutations, clawed hands, black talons, and skin bearing marks like burned runes. The systematic arrangement suggests not random experiments, but a methodical approach to creating more beings like Sebastian through demon blood injections, though none survive the transformation. A captured cultist, her skin gray and keeling, her scalp showing patches where hair has fallen out, reveals the tragic human element behind these experiments. The Church of Talto offers belonging to society's outcasts, who willingly accept demon blood injections despite watching their bodies deteriorate. The woman speaks of Lilith with the devotion of a child to a mother, describing how the demon goddess provided the family and protection she never had, even as the poison slowly kills her. This perversion of familial bonds mirrors Valentine's manipulation of his own children, suggesting his toxic influence extends beyond his death. Camille's revelation to Alec adds another layer of horror, describing how she systematically hunted Shadowhunters, collecting their blood for Lilith's experiments, combining demon and Shadowhunter blood. These attempts to replicate Valentine's success with Sebastian demonstrate how one person's evil can create ripples that affect generations, leaving a legacy of darkness that threatens to corrupt the very foundations of the Shadowhunter world. Lilith emerges as the novel's primary antagonist, a being of ancient malevolence whose origins trace back to primordial darkness. When she introduces herself to Simon as First of All Demons, she reveals a history that predates not just the Shadowhunters, but human civilization itself. Her connection to Sebastian unveils a complex and twisted maternal bond. She provided her demonic blood to Valentine for Sebastian's creation, secretly watching him grow up while disguised as an owl in Valentine's Arden. "I am almost his mother," she declares with possessive pride, having preserved Sebastian's body after Valentine's defeat with the grand vision that he would lead a new race of dark creatures, superior to both demons and Shadowhunters. Her intricate plan demonstrates both patience and cunning, hinging on exploiting the delicate balance between light and darkness in the universe. When Clary asked the angel Raziel to bring Jace back from death, it created a cosmic loophole, an opportunity for the dark to resurrect someone as well. Lilith's scheme requires two key elements: Simon's Daylighter blood, unique in its power to resurrect Sebastian, and Jace's presence as a counterweight. The symmetry is crucial. The first soul restored in the name of light must be present to restore the second in the name of dark, creating a perfect balance in the cosmic ledger. Lilith's psychological manipulation of Jace reveals her insidious methods and deep understanding of supernatural vulnerabilities. Because Jace died and was resurrected without the traditional protective rituals of the Shadowhunters, his soul was left exposed to demonic influence. Through carefully orchestrated recurring nightmares, she gradually marked him with a dark red rune over his heart, creating not just a puppet, but a perfectly controlled weapon. When Jace momentarily breaks free from her control during the confrontation on the rooftop, she taunts him about the fundamental cruelty of angels, demonstrating her ancient hatred for celestial beings before summoning hellhounds to attack with savage precision. Her most chilling moment comes during a confrontation when Jace challenges her to single combat, adhering to the Shadowhunter Code of Honor. Her response cuts through such pretenses. "I am a woman. I will use any weapon and all weapons to get what I want." This declaration encapsulates Lilith's essence, a being of pragmatic evil, completely unconcerned with concepts of honor or fair play, focused solely on achieving her goals through whatever means necessary, whether through manipulation, violence, or dark magic. When Simon's Mark of Cain ultimately triggers her destruction, transforming her physical form into salt crystals, it initially appears that her threat has been neutralized. However, the novel's final pages reveal the true extent of her cunning. The supernatural connection she created between Jace and Sebastian remains intact, with matching marks on their chests suggesting a deadly symbiosis. If Sebastian dies, it could potentially destroy Jace as well, ensuring that Lilith's influence continues to shape events even after her apparent destruction. This lingering bond serves as a testament to her power and foresight, leaving a complex challenge that extends well beyond her physical presence in the story. The novel culminates in a ritual of resurrection that binds Jace and Sebastian through blood magic. After Lilith's destruction, Jace remains on the rooftop to guard Sebastian's coffin while the others leave. Against his will, his body turns toward the coffin as it begins to glow with an eerie greenish light. Sebastian's voice whispers in his mind, "Did you think you were free because Lilith is gone? The vampire's bite woke me. Now her blood in my veins compels you." The ritual itself is horrifically intimate. Jace slices his palm with Valentine's silver dagger and lets blood drip onto Sebastian's face. When Sebastian's black eyes fly open, he sits up in the bloody water, cuts his own palm, and grips Jace's hand, pressing their wounds together. As their blood mingles, red lacework binds them together, creating a supernatural connection that overrides Jace's free will. This blood bond represents the novel's darkest moment. Jace, who has fought so hard against becoming like Valentine, finds himself unwillingly connected to Valentine's true son. The image of Clary in his mind recedes into darkness as Sebastian's voice flows through their shared blood. "We are one now, little brother, you and I. We are one." This forced brotherhood perverts the family bonds that Jace has built with the Lightwoods, creating an unnatural connection he cannot escape. The ritual's completion suggests that while Lilith may have been defeated, her plan succeeded in its essential goal, resurrecting Sebastian and binding him to Jace. This connection creates the perfect weapon against the Shadowhunters. Jace's fighting skills and insider knowledge combined with Sebastian's ruthless nature and demonic power. The matching marks on their chests ensure that the Clave can't simply execute Sebastian without potentially killing Jace, creating an impossible dilemma for those who care about him. In this final twist, City of Fallen Angels transforms from a story about overcoming past trauma to one about being literally bound to it. Jace's struggle against his perceived connection to Valentine becomes tragically literal as he finds himself magically tethered to Valentine's true son, a bond that threatens everything he holds dear, especially his relationship with Clary. City of Fallen Angels concludes with a profound meditation on the cost of cheating death. The novel opens with an epigraph from Jeremy Taylor about exterminating angels that strike invisibly from darkness, and closes with a quote about payment. "For every profit in one thing, payment in some other thing. For every life, a death." This cosmic accounting becomes literal through Lilith's explanation of supernatural balance. Clary's request for Jace's resurrection created an opportunity for darkness to claim its own resurrection. What seemed like a miraculous happy ending in the previous book now carries unexpected consequences, suggesting that death cannot be so easily overcome without payment. The novel's final moments reveal the terrible price of Jace's resurrection as he finds himself unwillingly performing the ritual that awakens Sebastian. Despite his mental resistance, his body moves independently, completing actions that unite him with the very embodiment of what he fears most, Valentine's true son and heir. The strange peace that washes over Jace as their blood mingles suggests a fundamental alteration of his being, his identity merging with Sebastian's through supernatural means. This forced connection creates an existential horror worse than death, the loss of autonomy and the corruption of self. Jace, who has defined himself in opposition to Valentine, now finds himself bound to Valentine's legacy through Sebastian. The vision of limitless power that replaces his love for Clary represents the ultimate corruption of his values and desires. The novel thus ends not with resolution, but with transformation, Jace becoming something other than himself through blood magic that overrides his will. This disturbing conclusion suggests that some prices are too high to pay, some bargains too costly to make. In resurrecting Jace, Clary inadvertently created the conditions for Sebastian's return and Jace's bondage, demonstrating that interfering with death's finality carries consequences beyond mortal understanding. As Sebastian declares their new brotherhood, "We are one now," the novel leaves readers with a chilling question. Is it possible to save someone whose very blood has been magically bound to darkness? The final image of Clary receding in Jace's mind as Sebastian's influence grows suggests that love itself may not be enough to overcome this supernatural corruption, setting the stage for an even more desperate battle in the books to follow.